The Years of Lyndon Johnson. The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro. Part 1. Continued on cassette number 8, side 1. What was important to Johnson, they feel, was the acknowledgement, the deferential face-to-face acknowledgement, that he had the power. And what he wanted from power, power gave him. His personality hadn't changed. He still strutted, both on wheels. He honked his horn repeatedly as he drove up College Hill to make sure everyone saw him in his car. And on foot. I can see him now, walking up that hill, slinging his arms and talking to everybody with that smile. He was always head-huddling people. He always had something that they had to confer about. He was still as deferential as ever to professors and as domineering as ever to students. The same mixture of bootlicker and bully. The reaction of many students to that personality hadn't changed. The in-crowd still wouldn't accept him, would hardly talk to him, in fact. Lyndon was always the string-puller behind the scenes, says Joe Barry. He found those he could use and used them, and those he couldn't he worked behind the scenes to put down. And he was just anathema to me. The more idealistic students still noticed that if, when Johnson approached a group of students, he realized they were discussing a serious issue in campus politics, he would hastily walk away. He'd avoid us because he didn't want to have to take a position, one says. He never took strong positions, positions where you knew where Lyndon stood. He was only interested in himself and what could help himself. This reaction was still not confined to inns and idealists. His campus-wide nickname remained Bull. He still, on a campus on which women outnumbered men 3-1, had difficulty getting dates, so much difficulty that one student says that after Carol Davis, he never had a real girlfriend. His involvement in campus politics had, for some students, only intensified the reaction by piling distrust atop dislike, says Helen Hoffhines. He could be very gracious and very pleasant, but I just didn't trust him. He was likable, he was smart, but he would do anything to get his way. He was a very brilliant man, but he'd cut your throat to get what he wanted. Ella Sorella recalls the election that Horace Richards says Johnson stole. The students were so naive about politics that no one was quite sure what had happened, she says. But everyone felt it wasn't straight, and everybody felt that if it wasn't straight, it was Lyndon Johnson who wasn't straight. Thanks to his involvement in campus politics, however, the reaction was no longer universal. Though some students despised his methods, others, more pragmatic, were aware of the power that those methods had gotten him. This recognition complicated their feelings. Richards, who was one of them, a wry, sardonic, self-seeing man, admits that while he didn't like Johnson any more than he ever had, he made considerably more effort to make Johnson like him. It's just like everything else. If you feel this guy can help me, if he likes me, you're going to be awful nice to him. Quite a few students were coming to understand that Johnson could help them. He had power. He was secretary to the president. If there was anything to give away, he would know. It paid to know him. And, understanding, they acted toward Bull Johnson not with disdain, but with deference. It was quite noticeable that quite a few boys who had always said they couldn't stand him started to act now as if they liked him. In the way of human nature, some did like him. His keen eye had found men who enjoyed taking orders as much as he enjoyed giving them, had found in students like Bill Deason, Wilton Woods, and a freshman named Fenner Roth, individuals who related to domination in a way that pleased him, men he was to keep in his service 30 years and more. By the time he graduated, a small clique followed Lyndon Johnson's orders enthusiastically as well as slavishly. Some idolized him. Silent Little Woods, for example, not only ran Johnson's errands and did his dirty work with the girls, but wrote his editorials, the editorials in the College Star to which editorial writer Lyndon B. Johnson signed his own name. Lyndon was always loading me down with work. He'd say, "Write an editorial on Thanksgiving." I'd say, "Where am I going to get the dope?" He'd say, "Go to the encyclopedia," thereby making Johnson one of the few college students with his own ghostwriter, and furnishing material for Johnson biographers who, believing he wrote those editorials, have analyzed them in great depth. and Woods felt honored to be allowed to do so. We were immature, and he was mature, and he was smart. He could talk wonderfully. I could never talk like he could. Woods, who in later life worked for Johnson in many capacities, was at the age of 60 to write a paper analyzing Lyndon Johnson, the college student. Here's the way he differed from the other students. He differed in one respect. He always had more energy. His mother had absolute control of him. She protected him from debilitating habits such as drinking and dancing and playing poker, and therefore his energy wasn't sapped. Even some students who didn't like him respected him now. The respect was grudging. In Ella Sorella's words, it was the respect you'd give a politician who won a political office you knew he didn't really deserve. But it was respect nonetheless. Ella herself, for example, campaigned for Lyndon Johnson some years after college. Why? Because I also felt that he was very capable, had a lot of energy, and had the ambition to do things that other people didn't. The hostility that many of his fellow students felt for Lyndon Johnson is striking in its depth and passion. It does not surface immediately, for not only is it deep, it lies deep, deep and hidden. The researcher begins his interviews on Johnson's college years expecting to hear about a popular campus leader. Because the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library has collected oral histories only from students who describe him in this way. The researcher's initial round of interviews confirms, in general, this expectation. If, when he interviews men who were not interviewed by the library, an Edward Pules or a Henry Kyle, he gets a different picture, he dismisses it as a biased view, the view of men who lost to Lyndon Johnson and were embittered by the experience. But there are enough puzzling hints, even in the interviews with men and women who praise Johnson, to make the researcher go back and re-interview them. And when he does, other feelings begin to surface. They surface slowly, because of fear. In some cases, they never surface. Joe Barry, at the time of his interview, a faculty member at the University of Texas, is not the only San Marcos alumnus who asks the researcher not to quote him by name because of the power, he says, the Johnson Group still wields in Texas. They could punish me, you know. He is merely one alumnus who at least agrees to allow his name to be used. Others never do. But when at last the picture comes clear, it is far from a picture of a popular campus hero. The researcher had at first dismissed Pules's remark that he was just the type of character who was snaky all the time, as the bitterness of a man defeated by Lyndon Johnson. Now, over and over again, he hears some version of that remark repeated by men who had no defeat to embitter them. The researcher had not even bothered to type up his notes of his interview with Kyle, an interview conducted at the very beginning of his research. So obviously prejudiced and therefore unreliable did he consider that old man. Now he finally persuades other men, a dozen men, to talk about the incidents which Kyle described. And he finds that Kyle described them accurately. By the time the researcher completes his work on Lyndon Johnson's college years, he knows that one alumnus had not been exaggerating when he said, "A lot of people at San Marcos didn't just dislike Lyndon Johnson, they despised Lyndon Johnson." But after Lyndon Johnson, returning from Cotulla, became involved in campus politics, the hostility felt for him by his fellow students was no longer universal, and it was no longer unmixed. To some extent, at least, power had done its work. If there was still disdain, there was at least a leavening of respect. Respect and fear. His power over jobs for students was, on that impoverished campus, real power. By the end of his time in San Marcos, says Ella Sorella, people wanted to make sure they didn't have his enmity. However he had obtained power, by broad-scale brown-nosing, errant flattery of the college faculty as a whole, and the college president in particular, by the tricking and manipulating of his fellows, obtain it he had. Lyndon Johnson had always wanted attention, and more than attention, he had always wanted people to look up to him, to show him deference and respect. Now, because he had power, he had, at last, a taste of what he wanted. And did that taste lighten the gloomy side of his character, the side seen by almost no one, but so striking to those who did see it? the sudden intense silences that Booty called loneliness, that one woman said meant that Lyndon was really down. The silences that were the outward sign of doubts and fears that tormented him, of the depression that could be lightened only by the one person in the world of whose love he was so sure. In December 1929, he wrote to her, "My dear mother, the end of another busy day brought me a letter from you. Your letter always gives me more strength, renewed courage, and that bulldog tenacity so essential to the success of any man. There is no force that exerts the power over me that your letters do. I've learned to look forward to them so long, and now when one is delayed, a spell of sadness and disappointment is cast over me. I've been thinking of you all afternoon. As I passed through town on my way home to supper, I could see the mothers doing their Christmas shopping. It made me wish for my mother so much." No matter how busy he was at San Marcos, he still made frequent trips home to sit on his mother's bed and talk. His torrent of letters to her, the testimony of his need for reassurance of his ability, had slackened not at all. Now that he possessed power, he was no longer without recourse against printed expressions of his fellows' enmity, as would be demonstrated, during his final term at college, by two incidents. Sometime during that term, the month cannot be determined, Star editor Milton Kennedy wrote an editorial satirizing Lyndon Johnson's relationships with the faculty and with President Evans. But the editorial never appeared, because, Kennedy says, Johnson went to Dean Speck. The newspaper had been set in type, and the presses at the Buckner print shop were just beginning to roll, when over their rumble Kennedy heard the telephone ring. When Kennedy answered it, Speck was at the other end. "Have you got an editorial in this issue about Lyndon Johnson?" he asked. And when Kennedy admitted that he did, the dean shouted, "Stop the presses!" Those were literally the words Speck used, Kennedy says. He demanded that Kennedy bring him the editorial, and after he read it, he ordered Kennedy to remove it from the paper and confiscated the few copies already in print. The feelings about Johnson that Kennedy had attempted to express did see print in the 1930 Pedagogue, however, those feelings and others. The Pedagogue's cat's claw section is liberally studded with uncomplimentary references to Bull for Bullshit Johnson, and while some of these references indicate only generalized dislike, Lyndon Johnson was recently asked if he was a college man or had a horse kicked him. Some are more specific. The qualities that his fellows believe they saw in Johnson are, in fact, itemized in his college yearbook. Set down in cold print are his determination to marry money, a fake advertisement to persuade students to join a Lonely Hearts Club entices him with the line, "Lyndon, some of our girls are rich," his penchant for flattering or sucking up to the faculty. Believe it or not, Bull Johnson has never taken a course in suction. His loudness and untruthfulness. Two entire pages are devoted to a denunciation of the elections the White Stars stole under his direction. He is depicted hiding behind one of his candidates, and the whole group of White Stars is pictured before a crude drawing of a nigger in a woodpile. And those pages include a question which testifies to the distrust with which other students viewed him. "What makes half of your face black and the other half white, Mr. Johnson?" In the 1928 Pedagogue, which called him a master of sophistry and of spoofing the public, sophomore Lyndon Johnson had been more harshly ridiculed than any other student at his college. In the 1930 Pedagogue, senior Lyndon Johnson was again afforded that dubious honor. As his fellows got to know him better, their opinion of him had not softened, but hardened. The 1930 Pedagogue is a detailed documentation of that opinion. The opinion of his peers about the young man who would one day be the most powerful man on earth. The Pedagogue was published in June 1930. Lyndon Johnson graduated in August, and the yearbook did not mar his graduation day, for by August the copy still available on campus no longer contained the pages in which he was so harshly ridiculed. They had been excised from the volume by the man who had been his benefactor all through college. Although probably little worse than other editions of the Pedagogue, the 1930 Cat's Claw section was particularly loathsome to President Evans, his secretary Tom Nichols was to write. Evans himself was to write that A number of pages aroused bitter resentment among our students. In fact, only one student was particularly resentful, but he was Lyndon Johnson. Johnson had a talk with the president, and following it, Evans ordered Nichols, Deans Noly, and Speck, and several trusted professors to cut out the section in every copy they could lay their hands on. It was removed from several hundred copies. His benefactor made graduation day a triumph for Johnson, in fact. Evans often said a few personal words about some student to whom he was handing a diploma, but his words about Johnson were unusually complimentary. When the tall, gangling young man strode across the rough wooden stage that had been erected near the bank of the San Marcos River, Nichols says, "There was a smile on Prexy's face before the youth came to a halt." Giving him his diploma, he put a hand on his arm to detain him, turned to the audience, and said, "Here's a young man who has so abundantly demonstrated his worth that I predict for him great things in the years ahead. If he undertakes his tasks in the future with the same energy, careful thought, and determination that he has used in all his work in the classroom, on the campus, picking up rocks, or as an assistant in the president's office, success to him is assured." The student's father, sitting next to Nichols, leaned over and whispered, "We shall never forget what President Evans has done for our boy." His mother wept for pride. 25 years later, Vernon Whiteside, a tourist in Washington, was sitting in the visitors' gallery of the Senate of the United States when, below him, the doors of the Senate cloakroom swung open, and the Senate's majority leader walked into the chamber. As he began restlessly roaming the floor, a few of the more knowledgeable tourists nudged each other and whispered as the tall man, talking to each senator, draped a long arm around his shoulder, seized his lapel, and bent into his face, eye to eye, for they recognized these characteristics from articles in newspapers and magazines. Whiteside recognized the characteristics, too, but not from an article. The man grabbing lapels and peering into eyes was a heavy man, clad in a suit of rich fabric, and he was grabbing and peering in a setting grave and noble. But so familiar were the gestures to Whiteside that these differences faded away, and he was seeing again a scene he had seen before, many times before, on a dusty campus on a hill in San Marcos, Texas. "To me, he was just like he was," Whiteside says. "He was the same Lyndon he always was, exactly." Whiteside was right. All the characteristics of majority leader and president Lyndon Baines Johnson that were so unique and vivid when unveiled on a national stage, the lapel grabbing, the embracing, the manipulating of men, the wheeling and dealing, all these were characteristics that the students at San Marcos had seen. And the similarity extended to aspects of the man less public. The methods Lyndon Johnson used to attain power on Capitol Hill were the same ones he had used on College Hill. And the similarity went far beyond the stealing of an election. At San Marcos, power had resided in the hands of a single older man. Johnson had begged that man for the opportunity to run his errands, had searched for more errands to run, had offered that man an audience when he felt talkative, companionship when he was lonely, and he had flattered him. Flattered him with a flattery so extravagant and shameless and skillful that his peers had marveled at it. And the friendship of that one older man had armored him against the enmity of hosts of his peers, had given him enough power of his own so that it no longer mattered to him what others thought of him. In Washington, the names of his patrons, of older men who bestowed power on Lyndon Johnson, would be more famous, Rayburn, Russell, Roosevelt, but the technique would be the same. So were techniques more complicated than reliance on a single older individual. The penchant for vote counting and vote changing that, during Johnson's majority leadership, was to entrance a nation, that penchant was there at San Marcos. The passion for deception, the obsession with secrecy, they were there too. Johnson's entire career, not just as a congressman but as a congressman's secretary, would be characterized by an aversion to ideology or to issue, by an utter refusal to be backed into firm defense of any position or any principle. That characteristic was evident at San Marcos. And the same also, of course, was the talent that was beyond talent, the natural genius for politics that animated all these techniques. From the day he arrived in Washington, Lyndon Johnson's rise would be spectacularly rapid. Yet in relative terms, what achievement was more spectacular than his achievement at San Marcos, where, within little more than a year after returning from Cotulla, not only did he create a political organization on campus, he created politics on that campus. Created it, and, unpopular though he was, reaped power from it. The man behind the methods was the same, too. In Washington, his fellows would be astonished by his frantic, almost desperate aggressiveness. That aggressiveness would have been familiar to his college classmates. The desire to dominate, the need to dominate, to bend others to his will, and the manifestation of that need, the overbearingness with subordinates that was as striking as the obsequiousness with superiors, had been evident at San Marcos. The tendency to exaggeration, to untruthfulness, in fact, the sensitivity to the slightest hint of criticism, the energy, the fierce, unquenchable drive that made him a man who worked harder than other men. His college classmates would have found those qualities familiar, too. Other qualities of Lyndon Johnson, less immediately evident to others, were present, not only in Washington, but at San Marcos. The viciousness and cruelty, the joy in breaking backs and keeping them broken, the urge not just to defeat, but to destroy, the iron will that enabled him, once his mind was set on a goal, to achieve it, no matter what the obstacles. Above all, the ambition, the all-encompassing personal ambition that made issues, impediments, and scruples superfluous. And present also was the fear, the loneliness, the terrors, the insecurities, that underlay and made savage the aggressiveness, the energy, and the ambition. He himself saw this. On the day he returned to reminisce at his old college, he said, "The enduring lines of my life lead back to this campus." The Lyndon Johnson of Capitol Hill was the Lyndon Johnson of College Hill. To a remarkable extent, nothing had changed him. Nothing could change him. Some men, perhaps most men, who attain great power are altered by that power. Not Lyndon Johnson. The fire in which he had been shaped, that terrible youth in the Hill Country as the son of Sam and Rebecca Johnson, had forged the metal of his being, a metal hard to begin with, into a metal much harder. In analyses of other famous figures, college, being only part of the formulating process that creates character, deserves only cursory study. But the years Lyndon Johnson spent at college are revealing of his character as a whole. All the more revealing, in fact, because at college there are no complications of national or international politics or policy to obscure character. All the traits of personality which the nation would witness decades later, all the traits which affected the course of history, can be seen at San Marcos, naked and glaring and raw. The Lyndon Johnson of college years was the Lyndon Johnson who would become president. He had arrived at college, that Lyndon Johnson. He came out of the Hill Country formed, shaped, into a shape so hard it would never change. Chapter 12. A Very Unusual Ability. Even before he graduated from college, Lyndon Johnson had demonstrated that he was a master of politics beyond the college level. Pat Neff, the former governor of Texas, who in his new post as state railroad commissioner had given Sam Ely Johnson his bus inspector's job, was campaigning for re-election to the commission and was scheduled to speak at a political barbecue and speaking in the Live Oak Grove outside the town of Henley in July 1930. Lyndon, eager to hear the only orator in Texas who bore comparison to the mighty Joe Bailey, accompanied his parents. But when, with darkness falling, after a long procession of candidates for local offices had followed one another to the speaking platform, the bed of a wagon under an old oak, the master of ceremonies, Judge Stubbs of Johnson City, called Neff's name, no one responded. The judge asked for a substitute to speak on Neff's behalf, but there was still no response. Once, Sam Johnson would have spoken, but Sam Johnson didn't give speeches anymore. "Lyndon," he said, "get up there and say something for Pat Neff." Stubbs, reports one of the earlier speakers, Welly K. Hopkins, a young state representative who was running for state senator, was in the act of declaring a default when a voice called out, "Well, I'll make a speech for Pat Neff." And here through the crowd came this tall, brown-haired, bright-eyed boy, kind of, with a bushy-tail attitude of vigor. And he repeated it. he would make a speech for him, so the master of ceremonies handed his hand down to him and pulled him up on the tailgate. "Sam Johnson's boy," Stubbs said. That made the crowd sit up, and Lyndon made his first political speech. "He talked in the dark," recalls Wilton Woods, who was sitting with the Johnsons. "The only light was the light from the barbecue fire, a big fire. He talked loud and a little bit squeaky like an adolescent, but I was impressed." So was Hopkins. He spoke maybe 5 to 10 minutes in a typical fashion, a little bit of the oratorical effect, and a good one, some of the arm-waving that I guess I'd indulged in some too. But he showed pretty good cause why Pat Neff should be re-elected, and was favorably received. Approaching Johnson after he had returned to his family, he asked him why he had made the speech. "His reply I've never forgotten," Hopkins says. "It was, in substance, 'Governor Neff once gave my daddy a job when he needed it, so I couldn't let it go by default.' We became friendly familiar, you might put it, within a very short time." Hopkins asked Johnson if he would help in his campaign, and he very readily consented. Hopkins had expected a tough campaign, but he was to win by more than 2,000 votes, a large margin in the Hill Country. And the reason, he was to conclude, was the lucky chance that had led him to meet Lyndon Johnson. Johnson provided him with campaign literature. When Hopkins ran out of money to print his own, Johnson, because one of his white stars was night watchman in Old Main, was able to use the college mimeograph machine and stationery supplies. He provided him with campaign workers. Some white stars, Woods, Deason, Richards, Fenner Roth, were persuaded, just for the fun of it, as one recalls, to drive with Johnson to the little towns in the 6-county Senate district. They would pile out of his Model A roadster on Main Street, press literature on every passer-by, and talk up the candidate's virtues. He provided him with a clack, a loud one. Arriving at a speaking before Hopkins, the white stars would quietly spread out through the crowd. Hopkins, a renowned stump orator, began his speeches by ostentatiously rolling up his shirt sleeves, as if preparing for a hard job ahead. At that signal, Richards recalls, "We'd start cheering and get the whole crowd cheering." And provided Hopkins campaigned with the same fierce, driving, driven energy he had given to Deason's. In so sparsely populated a district, every vote counted, and it seemed to Hopkins every vote was courted. "Lyndon knows every man, woman, and child in Blanco County, and has wide acquaintance in Kamal, Kendall, and Guadalupe counties," he was to write, "and no acquaintance lived in a homestead too isolated or at the end of a road too rough to be paid a personal visit. We worked Blanco in and out," he recalls. "I guess I was up every branch of the Perdinalis and every dry creek bed there was. I rode all the byways with Lyndon." Once, at Lyndon's insistence, he found himself not merely visiting but giving a speech to an audience of 3 persons. And, Hopkins saw, Lyndon Johnson was providing him with something else, too. Over and over again, he would recall in later years, he saw the tall, gangling college boy put his arm around a doer farmer, pump his hand, talk to him earnestly, smile winningly into his eyes. And over again, he saw the farmer smiling back at Lyndon before the conversation had ended. Writing to a friend about the campaign worker he had found at the Henley barbecue, Hopkins said that he was gifted with a very unusual ability to meet and greet the public. To meet, to greet, and more. Not a month after he had seen a gangling college boy scrambling up onto a wagon tailboard, he was to recall, "I kind of turned my campaign over to him in 4 counties. I followed his lead completely." For election eve, August 1st, Hopkins had planned a big rally in New Braunfels. Johnson said he should hold another one as well in San Marcos. When Hopkins said he couldn't get from one to the other in time, Johnson said he could, barely. He had timed the route. And when, at the end of a wild ride through the Black Hill Country night in Johnson's roadster, Hopkins arrived in San Marcos, he found a rally like none he had ever seen in the Hill Country. It was being held in the auditorium of Old Main. That in itself was unusual, for President Evans, leery of becoming embroiled in partisan politics, did not generally allow the use of college facilities for political rallies. And sitting on the platform was Evans himself, and that was unprecedented. Somehow, Johnson had persuaded Prexy Evans, the most respected man in the area, to lend silent support to Hopkins's candidacy. The audience was, by Hill Country standards, huge, jamming the auditorium. Flyers had flooded the campus and town for days to ensure that. And it was enthusiastic. When Hopkins strode out on the stage, a cheer went up, a cheer led by the familiar voices that he had been hearing at picnics and barbecues for weeks. And when he rolled up his sleeves for the last time, it grew even louder. And as the audience filed out after his speech, student volunteers, standing at the door polite and respectful under the eye of his new young friend, passed out more flyers, mimeographed by his new young friend, summarizing the speech's main points. He had just had his campaign climaxed, Willie Hopkins realized, with a rally planned down to the last detail. "He did a magnificent job for me," Hopkins says. "I always felt that he was the real balance of the difference as to whether I'd be elected." Other politicians felt the same way. Bill Cottrell recalls coming to Austin and hearing over and over again about this wonder kid in San Marcos who knew more about politics than anyone else in the area. Cottrell was in Austin to organize Edgar Witt's campaign for lieutenant governor. Believing that Witt had no chance in the Hill Country counties, and feeling that there was nothing to lose in turning them over to a novice, he drove out to San Marcos and put the young man he met there in charge of 8 or 10 counties. Witt carried every one. Hopkins, active in Witt's campaign, said, "Never have I seen better work." He had become not only professionally but personally fond of Johnson. Shortly after Johnson's graduation, he took him on a week-long spree in Laredo and Monterey that cost $100. A pretty good-sized sum of money in those days. But while Hopkins could give Johnson a good time, he couldn't give him a job. Johnson had decided by now that he wanted to make a career in politics rather than teaching. But with the Depression forcing the state government into staff cutbacks, there was no state job available. And he had already found out that there was no teaching job available either. His father's brother George, who had remained an idealist but, having fled the Hill Country, had escaped the worst of idealism's consequences, was chairman of the history department at Sam Houston High School in Houston. A tall man with big ears and piercing eyes, he was very popular with students, despite their tendency to mock his reverence for figures such as Andrew Jackson and William Jennings Bryan, who he believed had fought for the people. When, some months before graduation, Lyndon had asked him for a job at his school, he agreed to get him one, although because the Depression was forcing the Houston School Board to restrict hiring, the job, which paid $1,600, was contingent upon the occurrence of a vacancy. Months passed without such an occurrence. Lyndon tried other school boards. By now there was almost a note of desperation in his efforts. A talk by President Evans to his seniors during the spring of 1930 was entitled, "All Dressed Up and No Place to Go," and his sober listeners knew exactly what he meant. The diploma, which had cost them so many bales of hand-picked cotton, so many hours on the rock squad, was rapidly turning into worthless paper. Ellis O'Rella, perhaps exaggerating slightly, says that only 3 August graduates of San Marcos had jobs waiting for them. When Lyndon, who wasn't one of the 3, heard of an opening in Brenham, he deluged the Brenham board not only with letters but with telegrams of recommendation from every top administrator and faculty member at San Marcos. The warmth of these missives was all he could have asked for, impressive testimony to the opinion of his elders. Mrs. Netterville, who believed, because of his examination paper note, that she had strengthened his faith during her Browning course, called him a young man of great spiritual force. Another professor noted that Johnson has a habit of making friends of the best people wherever he goes. But the Brenham board sent them back, with regrets. The position he finally obtained was in South Texas, not far from Cotulla, in Pearsall, the other town which broke the bleak flatness that stretched south from San Antonio. Pearsall was even smaller than Cotulla. Its single hotel had so little business that residents believed it was the only self-service hotel in the United States. Guests selected their own rooms, put a dollar in an envelope, and dropped it into a box at the unmanned front desk. Carol Davis had taught in Pearsall, but Carol was married now. had been married in June in what the San Marcos Record called an impressive ring ceremony in the spacious Davis home, with the bride very beautiful in a long white dress as she swept down the long stairway. There is no direct evidence of Lyndon Johnson's feelings after, in September 1930, he left San Marcos and drove back down to South Texas. None of the letters he wrote to his mother survive. But his brother and his sister Rebecca remember that there seemed to be one every day, and every weekend, as soon as he had finished his last class, Lyndon Johnson drove home. Not many such trips were necessary. In October, a position opened in the speech department in Houston. Johnson had assured his uncle that, in the event that I can secure the place in Houston, I can resign this place at any time. That had not been the precise understanding of the Pearsall superintendent, George Barron, who says that he was, in fact, a bit stunned to lose a teacher in the middle of a term, particularly a teacher of such promise. Johnson, he says, took on the task as though the future of America depended on what he taught those children. But, he says, Lyndon took a seat on the corner of my desk, and, abandoning all formality, he said, "George, I look upon you as an older brother. I feel somehow that you have a kindred feeling toward me. If I didn't feel that way toward you, I wouldn't make this request." And, he says, Lyndon had a replacement ready, his sister Rebecca. Barron agreed to release Johnson from his contract, and near the end of October, Johnson arrived in Houston, where he moved into a two-story white frame house, owned by other relatives, on a tree-shaded street. He shared a room with his uncle. Houston must have looked huge to Lyndon Johnson as he drove toward it across the flat Gulf plains in his battered little car. From miles away, the setbacks of its skyscrapers, 30 stories high and more, cut right angles out of the blue Gulf sky. The long lines of factory smokestacks before them belched out plumes of smoke like banners announcing a new age for Texas, and the last miles before he reached the city were covered with forests of oil derricks. With its population closing in on 300,000, Houston dwarfed the cities of his youth. The high school in which he was to teach, with its 1,800 students, was twice as large as his college, and its faculty had more advanced degrees than the San Marcos faculty. But if he felt intimidated or unsure, he gave no sign of it. While informing Lyndon that he would not only be teaching public speaking, but coaching the debating team, his new principal mentioned that the team had never won the city championship, and Lyndon announced that it would win this year, and would win the state championship as well. Public speaking at Sam Houston High School had been taught by a mild-mannered gentleman whose classes were rigidly decorous. On the first day with Lyndon Johnson, every student had to stand up in front of the class and make noises for 10 seconds. "Any noises," Johnson said. "Ow, ow, ow," or "row, row, row." Just any noises at all. The next day it was 30 seconds, and the noises had to be animal noises. "Roar like a lion, quack like a duck." "You were sort of encouraged to be silly," recalls one of his students. He was trying to get people to feel comfortable on the podium, to make the whole thing such a game that no one would feel embarrassed. He'd do it with smiling and laughter to make you feel at ease. "Everybody's going to do it, so don't worry about it, just have fun." And we did. Even the shy kids did. There was a feeling that we're all comrades, we're all going to be doing these silly things, so we're all together in it. And everyone would laugh. Then came speeches. First 30 seconds, very short and on so limited a topic that you wouldn't be scared. Then a minute, and then 5 minutes. Speeches no longer extemporaneous, but prepared, and prepared thoroughly. "I have a memory of an enormous number of assignments," says one student, "and he was terribly strict about you doing them." Says another, "We had to do more reading for Mr. Johnson's course than all the rest of my courses combined. You really had to know your stuff." Then came the heckling. "No kidding, heckling," one student says. If the heckling wasn't fierce enough, the teacher would join in. Students could try to pick holes in the speaker's arguments, or simply insult him, or shout nonsense to try to drown him out. The idea of that was so you could keep your head clear and think logically of the arguments, no matter how much pressure you were under, a student says. Always the teacher was picking out flaws, not only in arguments, but in appearance. "Mr. Johnson wanted you to stand straight, but not stiff, to move your eyes around, No silly gestures, but make some gestures to show you're alive. And he'd shout at you, "Come on, Gene, stand up. Stop slouching. Who are you talking to, Gene? The ceiling? Look at the audience. Come on, Gene, look at them." Boy, he wanted you perfect. In general, his students didn't resent the shouting or the insistence on perfection. One of them, William Good, later a renowned sociologist, says this was partly because of the insistence. He made you feel important just because he's nagging at you so much. He's throwing his whole self into improving you. Partly it was because the students could see that he was working himself as hard as he was working them. When they handed in written assignments, the assignments were handed back the following day, always. And they were handed back with their margins filled with comments. For some months, another teacher, Byron Parker, roomed in the same house as Johnson. He remembers that sometimes, when he went to sleep, Johnson would be sitting at a little desk piled high with his students' papers. And sometimes, when he woke up the next morning, Johnson would still be sitting there, correcting the last of the papers. He had not slept that night. "He did that job as if his life depended on it," William Good says. His classes were very exciting, and everybody thought so. He wasn't a sit-down teacher. He strode back and forth and harangued. He was overpowering as hell. Out of his public speaking classes, the new teacher had to select a debating team. The two youths he chose were both, in those Depression years, delivery boys. But there, the similarity ended. Luther E. Jones, 17, known as L.E., was tall, handsome, brilliant, but stiff and aloof. "Smart as hell, but cold as hell," a student says. "And so reserved. I remember thinking, how the hell is he going to get up on a stage and sell himself?" Gene Latimer, a short, stocky 16-year-old whose hair never stayed combed, was, this student says, an Irish charmer with a cocky, wonderful smile and a marvelous gift of gab. But he was rebellious, insolent, notorious for not doing his assignments, always in some kind of mischief. They were not the ones people expected Mr. Johnson to pick, a student says. But Mr. Johnson was a reader of men. "At first, he's not my favorite teacher," Latimer says. "He impinges too much on my hours of leisure. In practice, he has no reticence in cutting me off in the middle of a sentence to comment on its inadequacy and to make pointed suggestions for improvement." Soon, the rebellious, independent Irish boy, who had never willingly obeyed any teacher, was waiting anxiously for an expression of approval in this teacher's eyes. In competition, he sits at the back of the auditorium and has an unsettling habit of frowning and ruefully shaking his head just when I think I'm on the right track. But once in a while, he opens his mouth in amazement at how clearly I am making a point. He sits up very straight and looks around in wonderment at the audience to make sure they're not missing this. And it is then he makes me think I have just personally thought of, and am in the process of enunciating, an improvement on the Sermon on the Mount. Johnson had somehow seen in Gene Latimer, as he had in Willard Deason, another man not easily led, someone who would accept his leadership, totally and unquestioningly. This book is concluded on the other side of this cassette.